Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Planet Zorg, and I am joined once again by the mighty himself. What's up, man?
Hola. That's Spanish for hello.
Yes. The Spanish word for hello. So tell me, sir, I don't know if you remember this movie. You told me to see it, so we're going to talk about it, the Snowpiercer. Do you remember this movie that you saw?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, so the movie came out kind of on the sly. I mean, I don't think many people were... It didn't get hyped a lot, but it's been getting a lot of good reviews. And it's actually on demand on cable, but it's also in theaters right now. So it stars the Captain America guy.
Yes, who happens to be the Human Torch guy as well.
Yeah, that's right. I think he wants people to forget that.
Yeah, yeah. But I should remind everyone, Captain America, played by the Human Torch.
Right. And what is his name again? Chris Evans, maybe?
Chris Evans.
Yes, yes. And so Snowpiercer is the story of a post-apocalyptic world this movie accepts the facts, or the so-called facts of global warming. I know you don't, but...
No, it doesn't really. It doesn't say whether or not they're true. What we do know in the film is mankind accepted that global warming is a real thing and attempted to do a global climate change thing, which backfired and turned the world into a snow-covered wasteland, killing off, like, just about everyone and most animal life, and actually I think supposedly all animal life. We discover in the end that there's a polar bear. But the remaining people are on this train called the Snowpiercer, which circumnavigates the globe. It takes a year to do that each time, and it's on a supposedly perpetual motion-driven train.
Is it that the train generates its own power by moving?
Well, yeah, sort of, kind of, yes.
Yeah, I was wondering what the mechanism was of power.
It's a made-up mechanism. perpetual motion doesn't exist.
Yeah, and it's funny because the plot unfolds apparently at 2014. So it's present day, or at least a alternate version of present day.
Yeah, you could say that.
And it's interesting because I guess it's the engine that is considered this kind of sacred thing, and it is a perpetual motion engine, some goofy technology that hasn't been invented, but obviously it hasn't been invented. I think things would be a lot different.
Well, it hasn't been invented because it can't possibly exist.
Exactly. So this is when the everything went to shit in 2014. But then we jump forward 31,
right?
This is kind of the result of these drastic anti-climate change measures that they've taken. A completely iced up planet, no life, and the only humanity surviving within a train. Now, we have basically the train is divided up according to class, or there's the super rich people living in the very luxury area, and then you have kind of the worker train, and then you go back all the way to the kind of homeless
they're welfare recipients, basically. It's essentially it's people. The class system is generated by the people who could basically buy berths aboard the train. I don't think it's ever fully explained how they buy things. I guess they provided material goods, which they were able to purchase at the time. And then the tradesmen who can perform trades, and then the people who basically just, like, leech off of the others and get protein blocks and occasionally give up some of their kids for some mysterious purpose up front. And these and the plebeians at the back are the ones who rebel at the end. And once again, we find out that there have been several rebellions, and they decide that they're going to go to the front cars and take them over.
Right. I mean, it's just they've had a number of rebellions, and they've all failed. And you can imagine why. I mean, it's a heavily guarded front section, and they need to take in order to conquer this. I mean, essentially the world, because this train is the world.
Right. That's actually a really important story element.
You have to capture the engine, and it has a kind of a Wizard of Oz quality to it in many ways.
Ed Harris is great as what's the guy's name? Milford, I think.
Yeah, Milford. They all worship the developer of this train, who, of course, was laughed at when he first came up with it. But at least that's the 1984 like story. It's a kind of a 1984 type society where there's just all this jingoism and. I don't know what you would call it, but just sort of mind control.
Well, you see a little bit of that. You see it in the school scene where they go through and the school kids are, I think, being taught, like, you know, just kind of a, you know, blindly accepted version of their history. You don't really see a whole lot else of it demonstrated anywhere.
Well, what I saw that is, I mean, when I looked at that and you know, the little mythology that they were told, you know, about this developer of this engine. I don't know. I mean, do you think that was a sort of a satire on our own religious myths, or do you think it was just the...
I think it's just a construct used to further the storyline.
Okay. Yeah, I guess you could look at it either way. But I thought this had a tremendously Philip K. Dickian aspect to it. I mean, did you find that, or do you think that...
Well, sort of. I mean, it's missing the most important component of Philip K. Dick's stories, which is the Gnostic element, the savior who comes in from the outside to fix things. That's completely missing, because Curtis is not that. Curtis is from inside.
Right, and we should talk about the character of Curtis, who... it comes revealed through the movie that he's not such a nice guy, and that there was a time when there was no food in the back part of the train at all.
Right.
And the only way that they just would collect people and just let them starve to death in the back there, and eventually they started eating each other.
That's
the weak, the weak and the sick, and he admits that he knows that the children tasted the best, so they had even stooped to killing the children and eating them.
He had actually kidnapped his assistant, Edgar. The way that they hooked up was he had kidnapped Edgar when Edgar was a child with the intent of eating him, and Gilliam, the John Hurt character, had cut off his own arm and offered it to him to save the child. And that's when he kind of went through a change, Curtis.
Yeah, and now we find out eventually that the whole thing was staged
on
some level.
Sort of, kind of, not exactly staged, but the revolution was staged. Whenever they have a revolution, it's basically Wilford and Gilliam. Because Gilliam is the guy who's, like, kind of in control in the back, sort of, kind of, and Wilford controls the rest of the train. And the two of them reach an agreement to have periodic insurrections, as a means of population control.
Yeah, they couldn't. The train couldn't survive with a growing population. Obviously, there's limited resources, so there was this always a plan to get a rebellion going, kill off a bunch of people, including maybe even people in the upper parts of the train.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's taken for granted that people in the front of the train are going to die at some point if they get that far.
But it seemed clear to me that that initial kind of troop of gimps that they sent in to quell the rebellion was probably where they intended it to end, where they sent in those masked guys with the clubs and spears.
Yeah.
What I thought really was interesting, too, was there was this idea that the bullets had all been exhausted. There was no more bullets. So the guns that they were pointing at them in the back part of the train, they kind of suspected weren't even loaded. And I think they come to that realization that they don't have bullets.
But it turns out to be untrue. They do have ammunition in the front.
I know, and we get that great scene in the classroom where they're teaching about the myth of Wilford.
They whip out the teacher and the children whip out machine guns. And
yeah, it's awesome. It's very Tarantino-ish. I don't know what you would call it, but you get this very nice scene where the kids are being taught, and then all of a sudden the teacher, this like little blonde girl, you know, takes out a gun and just starts, you know, machine gunning, saying how like that, you know, there's another myth.
First, she points out a bunch of frozen rebels through the train window. You can see like a bunch of people who had been rebels previously, and they were just outside frozen. Like,
yeah, there was like a foursome of them that were the leaders of the last rebellion, or they were the leaders of the last troop to try to leave the train.
There were seven. It was the seven.
Seven, that's right. And they never left. I mean, they didn't want you ever to leave, obviously, and the idea was that you couldn't leave, that you would just die, you know, and they'd kind of all say it together, like, so they maintain that ideology that the train is all, you know, we have, and you can't leave, and there's nothing out there, all you're going to do is die out there when you go. So, you know, because you wonder why people don't just hop off this thing. But, I mean, I wonder how cold it is out there. I mean, is it like, you know, the North Pole or even 10 times worse? Or I guess it must
be. No, it's made very clear to us that it's really, really, really cold. Like, so cold that people can't survive. And that it's getting worse all the time.
And in one scene, they have a little mini kind of skirmish at the beginning when they attempt to take the boy of somebody they have this strict measurement for what, you know, for what they need. They're taking children up to the front, and
right.
No one really knows what they're taking them for, but they take this one, and then there's a skirmish, and the guy who gets in the most licks, I guess he gets punished the most. The guy from the back of the train, who they force him to put his arm outside, and it becomes
right.
Like a frozen block, and then they just smash it.
Right.
Oh my God, yeah, it's pretty hardcore scene. I mean, this movie is pretty graphic, and it's definitely not for. I mean, it's got some disgusting images, not the least of which was the discovering of what they ate, which were these blocks of protein blocks, you know, these brown gelatin-looking things. And, you know, people just hated them, and that was all that they were given as food. It should be noted that this after the event, which you're saying was an actual natural event where the guy cut off his arm. I mean, if he's working with the guy in the front, didn't he plan to cut off his arm, which is kind of an odd thing.
No. He cut off his arm to prevent an act of cannibalism.
Right, but that guy we discover was working. It was Curtis, right? And so,
I'm pretty sure that Milford did not know that Curtis was going to kidnap a baby to eat him.
I see. Well, this guy he had planned this rebellion for population control with the guy in front, that they all kind of rally behind. They think he's sort of like their leader. It's not Chris Evans. I mean, it's the older guy, like you were saying. He is considered to be somebody who knows something, specifically because he doesn't have a limb. There was kind of like this weird thing where Chris Evans' character didn't think he could be great because he had all his limbs.
Right.
It's kind of an odd thing, but as if it was a badge of honor to have, like, given one of your limbs for people to eat, I guess. Or it was more like a symbolic gesture. But yeah, he was kind of the spiritual guru. And the first thing they have to do, the first key in the trying to take the plane, was to get the engineer, who was basically in a stupor of some drug that they all took, or that was...
Oh, I think is what it's called.
What was it?
I think it's called Chronol.
Yeah, Chronol. And who knows what was in it?
We don't know what was in it. It's chemical waves.
Really? So he's got this...
And explosive out of it at the end of the movie.
That's right, that's right. So when they go and rescue the guy, he's in some kind of drunk tank or something.
You mean Nangoong?
Yeah.
Nangoong is he's the guy who devised the security mechanisms for the various compartments of the train. That's why they need him.
Right. So they basically there's, you know, he doesn't want to help them. He doesn't think that it's a good idea, but I don't know exactly how he I don't remember exactly how he convinces Rangoon to work for him, but he gave him
Chronol. Nangoong and his daughter are Chronol addicts, and Curtis gave them like a huge supply of it in exchange.
Right. Okay. And it turns out they have another plan for this stuff because it is explosive. So they have their own agenda during this thing as well. So they make their way to, you know, they get through that big troop of like an army that they send after them. They get to the with the train with the kids where they finally get shot at. And so they start out a pretty considerable number, and and even the guy who was the baby that they were fighting over in, you know, this story here, he has to sacrifice, Chris Evans' character has to sacrifice this kid.
Yeah, so it's good that he didn't need him when he was a baby.
He needed him he has the chance to save him, and he just knows that he has to push ahead if this thing is going to succeed.
Because I'm not going to eat you now as an infant. The bad news is, like, you're going to be my buddy, and then I'm going to, like, totally, like get killed.
And what's interesting about his character is that he's struggling with the fact that he has been changed by, you know, what's happened, and that he's not a good guy. He's kind of a very selfish guy, and I guess he feels, like, you know, bad about that, and maybe some of the stuff that he's had to do to survive. But let's face it, like, if he wasn't like that, he probably wouldn't get to the front of the train as he does. So it's almost like his character that he's ashamed of is helping him
right.
throughout the movie. Like, just, he's a cold son of a bitch. He just, I got to leave you behind because I got to get to the front. And so he's kind of this, ambitious guy, and, you know, there's some interesting themes that just run through it with his struggle, his character struggle in this movie. But so I think Chris Evans does a good job of portraying that. I mean, what did you think of his performance?
Oh, I think his performance is great. It's really funny that he's virtually unrecognizable in the role. It took me like maybe 15 minutes to realize who he was. The movie has a very good cast. There's who else is in it? Tilda Swinton plays Mason. Gilliam is played by John Hurt. Ed Harris is Wilford. It's really kind of an awesome cast, considering this is, you can't really call it a low-budget movie because it was made for $40 million. It's made about $90 million. But it's certainly a lower-profile movie in this hemisphere. It apparently did super, super well in South Korea.
And so, okay, so when they get past that class of little kids, they're showing a film of the mentor, Gilliam, the guy who cut off his arm, getting shot as a punishment for, you know, that they're doing this rebellion. And
right.
So this guy is the sacrifice here. He also has this this henchman that he sends back there, who's quite a, I mean, I'm talking about the leader, Ed Harris, sends back this guy who's just like a machine, like a Terminator.
Franco. He's played by a Russian guy, Vlad Ivanov.
Franco the Elder.
There's also a Franco the Younger. There's two henchmen.
Yeah, and he looks like he's killed, and he Curtis pushes on. They go to this very indulgent kind of decadent part of the train where the elite are just like stuffing themselves and totally chronoled up. And you see Nam Gang basically stealing all the stuff that he I guess you think because he has this habit, why is it that what do you think that their plan is when they get to the front? Is it just to just, I mean, because it really does have to be segregated in this way for anyone to enjoy anything, isn't that kind of the idea?
Yeah, that's kind of the paradox in the film. It's like, I think one of the things the film is explaining, and the film is, at least as far as I see it, it's it's a meta movie. It's a metaphysical movie. It deals with things on a lot of different levels. You have to, it's basically saying, I mean, that's not the point of the whole film, but one of the things that the film is saying in terms of, like, this whole class system, it will exist. Class systems have to exist. If we don't have class systems, we have chaos.
Yeah, and I mean, it's there's an idea, too, that there's always going to be a underclass, no matter what, and if you try to rub it out, you're like you said, if you try to completely eliminate it, I mean, who you'll never be successful. There's something about society where it has to be ordered according to classes, unfortunately. And the problem,
like the Who, meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
So anyway, in the movie, when they get to the engine door, the Asian engine maker, he has his own ideas. Of course, he wants to use all the this drug, this kind of explosive material that actually is also this chronol, to blow open a hole in the side of the train and get the hell out and live outside. And he was married to an Eskimo, so he understands that by looking at the snow that's now falling and the snow flakes, because as we know, these Eskimos, they know the difference between snowflakes like none other. They understand that this freezing is actually going, that the temperature's rising outside, and that it is, the thaw is coming, and that it is, people can actually live outdoors.
Right. This at the very end.
So he thinks that's the solution, and not to take over the train, let these assholes spin around the earth. We're going to go outside. And Curtis just isn't going for that. He basically wants to get into that train. into that front part. And he finally gets there, and where we see a Ed Harris, who's kind of like the Wizard of Oz in this, who is enjoying a nice meal. He's got a nice, big, spacious abode, but it's like only he seems to be really doing well. Even the rich are all like crammed together, but he seems to have his own kind of solitude. But he sort of acknowledges that everyone has their station in life. This is mine. You know, there's some problems that I have. You know, I'm alone. I'm lonely. You know, he kind of explains to Curtis that this whole revolution was a great plan to thin the population, and then he also explains that he made the determination that he's old now and he has to retire, and that the new leader is going to be Curtis.
Yeah, he wants Curtis to take over.
Is that legit? Is he really saying that, or is he
I'm pretty sure he's legitimately saying that. I don't know if that was like his plan from the beginning of this particular rebellion, or if he came to that realization at the end of the rebellion, but he's legitimately offering that.
It's an interesting thing. I mean, where does Wilford say that he's going to go? I mean, where does Wilford go? Does he die? I mean, I don't know.
Well, I think he's just planning on retiring.
Right. Okay. So he said that the revolution turned out to be too successful, that they had to kill Gilliam, who was a partner in this thing, just because he kind of, I guess, messed up. Maybe this is some sort of retribution for not stopping the revolution. And you see Gilliam try to do it initially, where he's like, there's been so much bloodshed, why don't you just quit now, And the first thing they do is take control of the water, and they're able to parlay that into getting finally into the engine there. But when he confronts this leader, the leader, gives him the whole rundown, tells him he's going to be the new leader. And then he shows him, this little part of the engine that needs to be manned by a child for it to work, because the part can no longer be manufactured. And that sends Curtis over the edge, like, this whole operation is powered by the enslavement of at least one or two children, right? Or I think just one, but it has to be.
It's a few. Timmy, like, you see, but there's another kid down there that you see. So there's a few kids. You get the impression that there's a bunch of them that, as parts start to fail, they stick a small child down there, and he kind of like performs the function of the part.
Yeah, and until he wears out, and they have him under some strange mind. Like hypnosis or something, that they're like completely catatonic when they go down there, and they're programmed to just replace the child if it stops working. And it's a very kind of harsh realization. I mean, the grossest thing to me was the showing us where the food came from, which was essentially all bugs that they squished up into this paste, and then created little blocks, and that was the food that they gave the... And even the maker of this food was eating it himself. So it was really gross. I thought that scene was just really hard to stomach, no pun intended there. But this basically... Curtis then blow this whole operation up after seeing that? Is that kind of like the conclusion he comes to?
I think they disable the train and like basically run out into the world. But there's only a few survivors at this point.
The train completely blows up. It's only like it's only the Asian daughter.
It's
and a little black kid.
And I think there might be somebody else. I can't remember who else survives.
As far as I could see, it was two people. Like, they were going to repopulate the Earth, Like, when the little black kid grew up, he was going to do some go to town on that Asian chick, and that would be the new Adam and Eve.
That's Jimmy, Yona, and then they see the polar bear,
which
shows that there actually is life outside of the train, which means that life's existed all along. It's just been like, you know, cold life.
Yeah. So the Arctic animals look like they're surviving, but everyone else. But so yeah, so it was definitely a cool, riveting movie. I mean, it's weird because when I heard about it, I didn't think much of it. I was like, oh, that's kind of a weird idea, but turned out to be good. So is this a let's see, who directed this?
A Korean dude.
Yes. It's his name is
Bong Joon-ho, I think. Bong Joon-ho.
Yeah, Bong Joon-ho, and Bong, as in...
Yes, I guess Bong is his last name, because they do the last name first.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it's his familial name. So Joon-ho is his actual given name.
Yeah, because he's referred to as Bong in Wikipedia. But this was his debut for an English language film, and it was good. So definitely go check that out. And there's a lot of violence, and but I mean it's a high concept sci-fi thriller there. So definitely,
yeah, it's the best film I've seen all year.
Well, I mean. When you say that, is that really saying much? I mean, the films have been pretty shitty, haven't they? Or have you seen anything comparable?
Well, let's see. What have I seen that's like any good at all? I'm talking about big movies now. I watched Spider-Man 2, and it's kind of interesting because Jamie Foxx is actually sort of the best thing about the movie. I sort of like Andrew Garfield as Spider-Man because I think he's more like the real Peter Parker Spider-Man than Tobey Maguire.
Much more, yeah. He talks a lot, like in the suit, which is what Spider-Man always did.
And I'm not sure about the wisdom of reintroducing Gwen Stacy in the reboot as his love interest. It's too complicated.
Well, she's dead now, isn't she?
Well, yeah, okay, let's spoil it for everyone.
whatever. I mean, I don't think it got received well, that one.
I got to say, I really liked Man of Steel.
I loved it.
Yeah, that movie got slagged a lot, but I think it's a very well-made movie. The only problem I have is, like, the fight scenes are just a little too over the top. I mean, do we really have to, like, destroy Smallville completely and destroy half of Metropolis? That was just a little too much.
Yeah, it was far too... It lasted way too long, one.
Yeah.
And then they had two phases, and it was just tremendously destructive. And you would think that Superman wouldn't allow it, like in the original Superman 2, where he just directs them to the Fortress of Solitude so that they don't destroy the whole damn city. And you know, this Superman, I mean, it's a Nolan Superman. It's a darker version of Superman, isn't it?
Yeah, it's closer to the Superman that we first see in the Frank Miller graphic novel Dark Knight Returns. Because it's leading up to that. It's leading up to Batman versus Superman, which is taken from the last book of Dark Knight Returns, where Batman and Superman actually fight. And at that point, it's kind of revealed to us that Superman he hasn't been Superman for years. He's been a secret government agent, and he's working for the president, who looks like the president at the time, Ronald Reagan, but in reality is a robot made by the Soviets.
Really?
Yeah, which is kind of Philip K. Dickian, because the big revelation in Dallas is that Ferris F. Fremont, who's...
Nixon.
Is Nixon, right, is a Soviet double agent.
So it's... how long have they been doing the theme of, in the comics, of the superhero as sort of threat to government? You know, they've been kind of playing it up more recently, but
I think it first started with Batman in Dark Knight Returns, and then DC kind of left it alone, but Marvel really picked it up with X-Men. Well, no, with Avengers, by having like half the superheroes out there working for the government. Which is, you know, it's interesting. I kind of like that storyline because back in the 60s in the Marvel Universe, you didn't have superheroes working for the government. S.H.I.E.L.D. was a completely separate thing, and you did have, like, Captain Fury and S.H.I.E.L.D. would overlap, like, but Captain America and S.H.I.E.L.D. would overlap, but Captain America wasn't, like, an employee of S.H.I.E.L.D. That didn't happen until, like, much, much later, and Stark, Iron Man, Tony Stark, wasn't, like, working for the government. He was selling munitions to the government.
Yeah, I mean, but it's a more realistic take to have them more involved with the government than before, right?
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, and I think that it's all ridiculous. I mean, the idea that they exist, but let's just say that they do. Then you have, if you want to be real about it, then the government would be heavily involved with these individuals.
You see that in Watchmen, where the government steps in and outlaws masked vigilantes. Although in Watchmen, there's only one superhero. The rest are just guys who put on masks and fight crime or whatever. But there's only one superhero. That's Dr. Manhattan.
Yeah. Now, was that an original idea, or was that had that already been done in Marvel or DC?
I'm pretty sure that Alan Moore came up with it on his own.
Interesting, because
I should clarify. He might have been influenced by an ongoing storyline in DC, like back in the Silver Age, where they had Earth 2. And Earth 2 was like an alternate Earth where this is how they explain how there were like different Flashes and different Green Lanterns.
Right, they're alternate realities.
It's not just alternate reality. It's an alternate reality, but it's also what you see when you pick up a comic book. Because there's also an alternate universe Superman and an alternate universe Batman.
Yes.
And then they resolved, this got too complicated, and they resolved all of it with, I think it was called Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Well, no, Marvel did Secret Wars, and they did Crisis on Infinite Earths. Yeah, and it was sort of, they both did them kind of around the same time.
They did it as a means of allowing them to do reboots, sometimes multiple reboots, because then we got like these weird off-brand reboots where Tony Stark, we're following Tony Stark from when he's a boy, and it's a completely alternate universe Tony Stark, shit like that. Or the explanation of Captain America in the 50s, because let's not forget, Captain America went down in a plane with Bucky in the 40s in World War II, and then when they reboot his character in the 60s and make him part of the Avengers discover him trapped in a fucking floating block of ice, and he's been in suspended animation the whole time. So they had a little bit of a problem explaining how Timely/Marvel had a Captain America series in the 50s in which Captain America was fighting in the Korean War, along with Bucky, an older Bucky. And the way they explain this now is that Captain America was, he was a different guy. He was, I think, recruited to be, he was either a communist plant or he was recruited to be an American bit of propaganda and brainwashed into having what he thought were Steve Rogers' memories. He believed he was Steve Rogers.
But he really was.
He became a fanatical anti-communist and saw he saw communism everywhere, and they had to like kind of put him down, I think.
Well, it's funny. I mean, they go through so much pains to connect up stuff. It's just a story, so I don't know if people care. But yeah, so they got this. But you know what's interesting? I just saw the Captain America 2, and it's excellent. It's very good.
I actually watched the first, 25 minutes, and I thought it was great, but I was watching it through popcorn time. Yeah, popcorn time, and the file that I had downloaded was corrupt, so I just couldn't watch it past that point.
It has a Bourne ultimatum, Bourne, you know, kind of quality to it, but definitely a good story, and I just thought they did a good job of sort of isolating the action to like a single day, which would explain why the other Avengers weren't able to be called, you know, because sometimes I find that it's hard for them to make that, they'll have these kind of apocalyptic events occurring, and then you wonder why there's only one superhero here when they've clearly established there are more. But yes, yeah, so Thor, the Thor stuff, I just never got into. I tried to watch the two movies, and I didn't think they were, I don't know, they just didn't do anything.
I did not really care for the first one that much. I liked the second one quite a bit. But what mostly makes the Thor movies is the actor who plays Loki.
Yes. Yeah, and the second one was better, for sure. And his character arc is pretty great, where he kind of turns face. Does a fake heel turn back, which I thought was a good twist there.
Yeah, that was a twist. I liked that.
I bought it completely. So I was surprised by it. But yeah, his performance is great, and he also does good in Avengers, the movie. I don't know if you saw that big.
Yeah, I saw it. It's actually the first and the only 3D film that I've seen.
And the Hulk, I think they finally got the Hulk right.
Banner, right?
Yeah, well, they got basically a Bill Bixby lookalike, but he does good.
Looks like Bill Bixby. I was actually referring to Mark Ruffalo's kind of psychological portrayal of Banner.
Yeah, that is way from the comics. It is.
Yeah.
And his little the idea that Banner has always had an anger problem anyway, you know.
That really helps explain it.
Yes, and it explains why he mutated into this monster, because it's kind of like an expression of what's buried underneath all the time. I love that line in the movie where he's like, people don't understand, like, I'm always angry.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he doesn't. Yeah, I hope they come up with some standalone Hulk stuff, but I doubt they will. I think they're just
think they're giving up on that because it's failed too many times.
It has, but you think it's undoable, or do you just think that it's just tough?
It's tough. I don't think it's undoable. I mean, look at the failed Captain America projects that Marvel had before.
Yes, definitely. Those. I think they were Roger Corman films, those originals. They were pretty goofy looking.
There were a few boots of Captain America. If I remember correctly, Dolph Lundgren played Captain America in one movie.
The Corman ones were trying to make it like Adam West Batman type style, and it wasn't exactly working there. I thought the... they got it right with this guy, and I think Chris Evans is a good Captain America for sure.
And they've given up on Fantastic Four in terms of films. It's going to be a TV series.
Is that right? And what about I heard Hulk was going to be a TV series again,
Fantastic Four. I believe the Human Torch is going to be a black guy, which is going to be weird because Human Torch and Invisible Girl are siblings.
So she'll have to be black, too.
No, I'm pretty sure that she's not black.
Well, then they won't be siblings.
I guess you could explain it by one of them having been adopted.
That makes sense.
that's what I would do if I really wanted to do, like, a racially diverse cast, which I think is bullshit. I mean, I think it's fine when race is not germane to the character. Like, I don't have any problem at all with Samuel L. Jackson playing Nick Fury, because the race that he is, unless you're making him World War II Nick Fury, which we're not, the race that he is not important. He could be Chinese. It doesn't matter. But I think that Sue Storm and Johnny Storm are supposed to be real Midwest white bread people.
The next they're going to be doing is messing with the sexual orientation of superheroes.
There's already been a gay Green Lantern, but it was like a subordinate Green Lantern. It wasn't like, you know, Hal Jordan Green Lantern or the Green Lantern who preceded him. People forget that they've been doing tricks with superheroes for a long time. People are like, some people are outraged that Thor is going to be a woman. They're like, well, Thor is going to be a woman. It's like, dude, Thor was a talking horse for a while.
He was?
Yes. Beta Ray Bill picked up the hammer and became Thor for a while.
So now when you have, I understand they have rebooted in some universe the Spider-Man guy, and he's like a Hispanic guy. So and with a different name completely, which is
El
weird.
El Spider-Mano.
What?
El Spider-Mano.
I don't know, but I mean, it's weird when they do that. I think they're thinking like there's probably a division within Marvel that's like, okay, we have to, because, you know, let's face it, most of the superheroes that were developed in the 60s at Marvel were all white, except for like Power Man and the, you know.
Let's see. What black superheroes in the Marvel universe were developed in the 60s and early 70s? Luke Cage, Power Man, the Falcon. Let's not forget the first black superhero ever, Black Panther.
Don't even remember him.
Really? He's a Fantastic Four guy. He was originally kind of a bad guy, but then it turned out he's a good guy. He's a South African dude. His name is T'Chaka, I think. And he was like a chieftain or a king of some sort.
Now, it's mostly white, let's see, because the United States...
They're American. Most Americans are white.
Right. So it reflects, it's kind of, you know, percentage-wise, I think it does sort of represent the racial breakdown.
It's a little skewed in favor of whites, let's be real.
Right. So they're trying to figure out ways to redo certain characters. I just think it doesn't... To do a time-honored character like Spider-Man over is just ridiculous.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, it's an alternate universe Spider-Man, and it doesn't count, and it's not really going to appeal to that broad a base. I do think it's like totally not a bad idea to introduce new characters who are black or Hispanic or Asian or whatever. You know, I think that's totally fine, and it doesn't confuse people, and there's no reason why these characters can't, on their own merits, become major characters if they're written and drawn well. That's, you know, it's just that they've invested so heavily in their iconic characters that they don't want to give them up. They just want to, like, oh, we're going to, like, change this character into a woman and change this character into a black guy. And it's like, really, you know, really, are we? And let's not forget Iron Man was a black guy for a while.
Well, it also, yeah, well, actually, there was, he was, I was a different, wasn't that his assistant?
It was James Rhodes, it was Rhodey.
Rhodey, right.
When Tony Stark became a raving alcoholic and was, like, in rehab and shit, Rhodey stepped up and became Iron Man, and then he got so jazzed on being Iron Man that when Tony was fine, Rhodey didn't want to not be Iron Man, and they had like a falling out. But then they reconciled, and Stark gave Rhodey, I think, a few suits, and he became, what's the character? Is it Warhammer?
War Machine.
War Machine. Yeah.
Now when he was in the first movie, he was played by Terrence Howard, and
right.
I think Terrence Howard like demanded a shitload of money to do the next one, so they told him to fuck off. And they got, I believe it. Yes. Who does a great job. I mean, I think they both
Don Cheadle is actually really good as Rhodes. Despite his somewhat small stature, although he's not really any smaller than Robert Downey Jr.
Robert Downey Jr. had to be on stilts when he was hanging around with Gwyneth Paltrow, I'll tell you that, because she's a tall drink of water.
She's shorter than I am.
So you've been in person with her? Maybe she was on heels when I saw her, but
I've met her and spoken with her.
Why does everyone hate her?
I don't hate her. I think she's nice.
No, but she's kind of this. They've tried to turn her into a heel.
No, you know what it is. She is to a great degree a very sheltered girl. She's lived a life of privilege, and a lot of her social commentary is predicated on her having lived a life of privilege. There are elements of society about which she's totally ignorant and always will be totally ignorant. But that doesn't make her a bad person. It just makes her ignorant about some things, like most of us are.
She's got affluenza.
Well, that, I believe, is a term that's used to excuse wrongdoings.
Apparent wrongdoing, you know. But
I don't think Gwyneth Paltrow would hurt a fly.
Yes, yes, she would. And she's made some remarks that, like, have gotten people so in a tizzy, Mike. I mean, that's what you were saying, that she kind of lacks the tact that somebody has been.
And also some of her remarks are just blown out of proportion. It's like, they're remarks that, like, some hipster chick might make and you'd let it pass because she might let you fuck her.
It seems like there's this kind of, because she's so, like, pretty and blonde and just kind of represents, like, this mainstream image, they kind of like tearing her down. I mean, is there an element of that?
Yeah, probably. She represents kind of, and this is weird because, like, Martha Stewart commented on this, but I was going to say she represents kind of a younger version of Martha Stewart to a lot of people. But Martha Stewart, they essentially said that Gwyneth should keep her day job and not get into the social commentary and shit. But she's, I think people judge her a little harshly.
A little? God, man, it's amazing. And it's weird because it's something, you look at her, she seems perfectly nice, and she probably is. So it makes no sense in my mind. But her mother was, what a hottie. Her mom was still probably today. She's looking good.
She's aging, but she's aging gracefully. I like Blythe.
I just remember her in Free Jack with Mick Jagger.
Yeah, and which Sheen brother is that? Is that Emilio? I think. It's Emilio, not Carlos.
It's not. It doesn't go. It's not the Mystery Science Theater 3000 level of Emilio of Estevez. He populates a lot of their movies, by the way. This very unknown estimate, the Carlos one, I guess, is.
No, Carlos Estevez is Charlie Sheen.
Oh, that's right. That's Carlos. I'm thinking of, there's an Estevez brother that is all over the Mystery Science Theater movies, you know, those really crappy B, C, D movies, and he did.
Is that guy related?
He is. He is an Estevez, but I think he's the brother of Martin Sheen, which is, he never really got anywhere, you know. It's like one of what are some of these brothers that, like, of them are doing well.
Do you mean Bo Estevez?
Might be. Is he kind of Charlie Sheen's age?
No, he's older than I am.
He's older.
Martin Sheen is like an old guy. Any brother of his is going to be in his 70s.
Okay, maybe it's a cousin or something. But in any case, I just remember seeing him every time. A lot of those Mr. Science Theaters movies, they'd always point out this Estevez guy, and I'll be like,
but Joe Estevez actually has quite a list of films he's been in.
Now, and how? So he's about your age, right?
No, he's considerably older than I am.
Yeah, so maybe it's him. Are they like B science fiction movies?
Let's see. Little Lost Sea Serpent, Toad Warrior.
There you go.
Dark Universe.
A number of them have been, you know, lambasted by the likes of Mystery Science Theater.
He plays a character named Rocket Ranger Dan Danger in Guns of El Chupacabra.
Yeah, and see,
he appears in I Got the Hookup. Max Hell Frog Warrior, Vampire Boulevard. Let me see if I can find a recent one. Caesar and Otto's Deadly Christmas.
The hell is that?
He plays himself in a movie called The Perfect Candidate. He also did a movie called Not Another B Movie.
How recent is that?
What?
Not Another B Movie.
Not Another B Movie.
What year?
2011.
The man is still working, ladies and gentlemen. So
yeah. No, he works apparently like crazy. He's appeared in a bunch of television shows and TV movies.
Well, there's this huge kind of like under, you know, there's work for actors out there if they're willing to do stuff like that.
I'm not really sure how he does his SAG stuff, because he works under a number of different names, or has worked under a number of different names. He's worked as Joe Estevez, Joseph Estevez, Joseph Sheen, Joe Phelan. So that can really annoy SAG. So I'm not really sure how he does this.
Yeah, that's interesting. But he's kept his career alive, so good for him. I mean,
he's been working steadily in the TV and film industry since 1974.
He's probably doing a lot better than Emilio, even at this point.
Well,
right?
No, I think Emilio gets a lot of work.
I don't see him. Where the hell do you see Emilio? Well, and is he doing like that circuit of the B movie circuit?
I'm not sure, because I don't really follow.
Come on, man. I saw that poster on your wall.
right. Let's see his filmography.
Emilio. Now, I wish, why didn't he change his name? You know, I mean, it's just like the Sheen name seems to be more powerful.
I guess. Okay. Emilio's first film was in Apocalypse Now. He plays Messenger Boy, and his scenes were deleted.
What is it? You're a messenger boy sent to collect a ticket. You know, what was that line?
Yeah. He's appeared in such cinematic greats as, well, St. Elmo's Fire, of course. But he was in Maximum Overdrive, Young Guns 2, which were, I think, both very successful movies, Free Jack, which we just talked about, Mighty Ducks and Mighty Ducks 2, or D2, The Mighty Ducks. He's in the Jerky Boys movie. He's in, I think, the first Mission Impossible movie, but he's uncredited. Like, he plays a real character, but he's not in the credits. That's common. His most recent film was in 2010.
So he's still getting work, right?
He's still getting work, and he's been...
Was that straight to video?
Well, he's been acting in television pretty steadily, too. No, he's... I think he does all right. Oh, he's an Arthur in The Invisibles as a voiceover guy in the English dub version.
Well, I mean, he was more prominent years ago, obviously, than he is today. But I guess he's still getting work, so that's good.
He was a Brat Pack guy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he didn't have the charisma of Charlie when you get down to it.
Few people do.
Are you a fan, Mr. Charlie Sheen?
Charlie Sheen. I think Charlie Sheen is sweet.
Do you think that he is a... You think that he's out of control, or do you think he's a controlled partier?
I don't think he's out of control.
Yeah. He seems like It's like he likes the party, and you know, he does okay, and he's got the
Tiger Bud Warbach winning. Yeah, I think he's fine. I think Charlie is doing fine.
His show, when he was really huge, and he lost the show, I guess, because of his antics.
One of my favorite sitcoms.
What do you think of it now without him?
I haven't seen it without him.
So you're one of these people that are like, well, if Charlie's not on, I ain't watching this.
What's
shit.
The point of watching it? It's about Charlie Sheen.
I know. It kind of made no sense to put somebody else in there, but they've managed to do it. By all accounts, though, it's still a successful show, is it not?
Is it still on the air?
Yes.
Really?
It's got Ashton Kutcher.
Kutcher still in it?
Yeah.
It's still on the air?
As far as I know. I haven't really looked it up, but I think I'm still hearing about it.
Yeah, it's still on the air, apparently.
Because, I mean, that's amazing that they were able to survive without him. But... And do well. So the show, Ashton Kutcher is pretty funny. You know, I mean,
how do they explain? Does Ashton Kutcher just step in and play the Charlie Sheen role?
I have no idea. I never watched it before or after, but apparently it's very popular. Now, one of the biggest popular shows also is this Modern Family, and to me, you watch that show?
I've watched it. I'm not a big fan. I think it's effective. Back to Two and a Half Men. Didn't the kid in Two and a Half Men like flip out and become like a weird Christian dude?
Oh, really? I didn't know about that.
That's what I thought. Oh, they kill Charlie off, and then Ashton Kutcher buys the house.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And Alan, John Cryer, leaves with his son to live with the Holland Taylor character, their mom. But Walden, that's Ashton Kutcher, invites Alan and Jake back to live in the beach house because he's lonely.
Interesting. Well, maybe it worked out, you know. Maybe. They probably had some good writers, so, you know.
Also, I guess they get rid of Jake more or less, not really, but that he joins the army and then starts dating Jamie Presley. And then Scott Bakula comes into the storyline.
Oh, the guy from Quantum Leap and Star Trek.
Also from Lord of Illusions, which is a sweet movie.
Lord of Illusions what movie is that?
It's a Clive Barker movie about the illusionist who gets killed on stage.
Is that when did that come out?
Years ago.
Oh, so because there, what was that movie where the two magicians are like battling each other? I forget what it's called.
Do you mean The Prestige?
Yes, they kind of sort of like that, or is it?
I think it all like that. It's a Clive Barker story.
Mm. Oh, okay. It's more of a kind of horror movie.
Yeah, it's a horror movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, Prestige is a pretty sweet movie, too.
Prestige is one of the best movies made in the last 20 years. That's Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, that was awesome. But yeah, so the Charlie Sheen, though, I mean, he is quite a character there. His dad, too. I mean, his dad has been pretty steady worker. I mean, obviously he's a big guy, but you know, did a good job in the I don't know if you ever watched the American he played the president, didn't he, in that series?
Which series?
The one about the president. It was like he was all I forget was on. It was a long series.
Wing?
Yeah, West Wing. He was the president for the longest time, at least throughout that series. And then Jimmy Smith became president, which is kind of an interesting idea. But so you're are you confident, though, that they can keep this going? I mean, DC with Superman, it was not really well received. I they're still going to do Superman versus Batman next.
But Superman versus Batman is going to be an excuse to introduce Wonder Woman and some other characters as kind of a something that precedes or leads into the Justice League movie. Like, they're focusing heavily, I think, in the future on the Justice League, the way that Marvel decided to throw their bankroll into the Avengers.
They're playing catch-up, though, because, Marvel is much further along, obviously. And they're new. That I don't know if you checked out the new X-Men, Days of Future Past. That thing is a really good film. It seems like they're much more, they got their chops in the film department much more than DC at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you think that a Justice League movie is going to do something like Avengers numbers?
I think it depends on how they approach it. They can't get, they're going to have to keep it kind of bare bones. I don't think that they can get too obscure, like with a lot of the more arcane characters like Dr. Fate and whatever, or even Adam. I don't think that you can really like focus a lot on those characters. You have to keep it like Superman, Batman, Green Lantern, if we're going to bring Green Lantern back, because that movie was a failure. Wonder Woman, who else is out there as DC superheroes?
Well, you have Aquaman.
Oh, Aquaman is going to be a major part of Justice League, right.
And they are doing an Aquaman movie.
There's going to be an Aquaman movie. It's going to be with that dude who played that dude.
The Thor guy? No.
No. It's the guy who played, he's in Game of Thrones, and he was the new Conan in the more recent reboot of the Conan.
Oh, yeah. And now the guy who played Superman in this last movie is going to be in Batman vs. Superman.
He looks like Superman. He's good. I liked it.
Yeah, I thought it did a tremendous job. I thought it was a good setup for the Superman universe, and now you can have, you did the origin and whatever, so now you can do an adventure movie with Superman, and it should be pretty good.
Yeah, as long as you don't get too heavy into the weird shit, like the Legion of Superheroes and 8 different versions of Superboy at the same time, and Supergirl,
and Crypto. The Superdog.
Oh, the Superdog. I forgot about him. and what was it, Brainiac 2 or whatever his name was, the green guy?
It's got to be Brainiac. There was a Brainiac tease in the movie, wasn't there not?
Was there?
Yeah, there was. There's this...
There's a green guy?
No. The new Brainiac. There's a scene where a guy seems to kind of meld with a computer or something. I don't remember now, but somebody else pointed it out, and I the thing about it is I that would be good to have a Brainiac in the next Superman. I think he's a good villain.
I'm waiting for Lex Luthor.
Well, they definitely had a Luthor Corp. There was a truck that said Luthor Corp in the movie.
Yeah.
So they're definitely going to probably have him involved too, but the last Superman, they did Luthor with Kevin Spacey, and I thought he was a good Luthor, but
he was pretty good. I liked Gene Hackman as Luthor, of course. I've been watching recently the WB TV series Arrow, which is another DC thing.
Green Arrow?
It's called Arrow.
But it's about the Green Arrow?
It's Green Arrow, yeah. But the guy's never referred to as Green Arrow. Like, someone comes up with it as a possible name for people to call him, and he, in his secret identity, says, oh, that's lame.
it's true. I mean, they have to sometimes re-up the name because it is goofy.
He's referred to mostly as the Hood. Or the vigilante, or the guy in the hood.
That's hot. That's good. They're going to try to do the same thing with Gotham, bring in Batman they're going to do a Gotham series pre-Batman.
Right, right. And there's also, I think, a Flash series coming up.
Really? That should be. They've never worked out. I think they tried one recently, too.
But there was one in the 90s.
Well, they had Flash on the Smallville, right? Also.
Yeah, made an appearance. Okay, the Flash is going to be on, it's the same network, CW, so, and it's the Barry Allen Flash, and it'll be spun off from Arrow.
Well, that's cool.
It's going to premiere on October 7th.
So they've been trying to up those characters, but I don't know if they're going to be as successful as Marvel. I mean, it's surprising because you would think that the DC characters are more mainstream than the Marvel ones. I know that they were a bigger company for a long time.
Well, back in the day, they were back in the when I was first reading and buying comics, Marvel was considered kind of the alternative, and of course, then Marvel became huge. And you just had Marvel and DC and creativity in comics basically, like, dwindle. And then in the late 80s, there was kind of a
renaissance.
A renaissance of sorts. I guess you can call it the Bronze Age of comics, where you had all these alternate comic companies, like there was Kamiko.
Dark Image or something.
There's Dark Horse, which still exists.
Dark Horse.
I know. But there was Kamiko, which had a few really good titles. The most notable one was Grendel. And there was First, which had a number of titles, Nexus, Grimjack, Whisper. These were all, like, fantastic titles. And I think Nexus and Grimjack are still being published by maybe Dark Horse or Image. There were like maybe five or six different comic companies that were doing like serious stuff. Dark Horse was doing fantastic stuff. And then there was kind of, after this boom, there was a recession which really severely affected the comic book industry. And, the giants were able to pull out of it all, although, Marvel got sold. But
right. But Marvel is now owned by Disney. Do they ever absorb characters from independent Marvel? I mean, independent writers or
you mean the way that DC did with the Charlton characters? Because DC absorbed the Captain Marvel universe. Only they called it Shazam, and there's going to be a movie called Shazam this winter, I think. It's going to be called Shazam. It's not going to be called Captain Marvel, and I think his character is going to be called Shazam too.
There was a Captain Marvel in Marvel too, yeah. Which is kind of funny.
Yeah. There were a few Captain Marvels, and that created some problems. And so when DC brought Captain Marvel back, they called him Shazam, which is the magic word that Billy Batson says to change into Captain Marvel, and it's an acronym. It's the various attributes characters that Captain Marvel has. Like, he has the wisdom of Solomon, the strength of Hercules, shit like that. The power of Zeus.
Well, he's their Superman.
Well, yeah, except then DC picked him up and consigned him to oblivion. But DC also picked up characters from the Charlton universe. Captain Atom, which was wonderfully drawn by Steve Ditko back in those days, the creator of Spider-Man, Blue Beetle, a few other characters. The Question. DC came up with The Question. And then DC also, through Alan Moore, based a character in Watchmen upon The Question, the character of Rorschach.
Now, When you go back to Captain Marvel, though, didn't he predate Superman?
No.
Oh, okay. So Superman was the first of the winged guys.
You mean caped guys?
Caped guys.
I don't think he has wings.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Caped. The caped Superman is the originator. Is the Superman?
Right? Yeah, yeah, it's Superman. And Captain Marvel came along a few years later. Bizarrely, Captain Marvel's facial features were patterned after the actor Fred McMurray.
Well, he's remarkably Superman-ish. I mean, I'm surprised they didn't try to sue them for coming out with that.
It's a really famous lawsuit. It was a major lawsuit.
Oh, there was a big lawsuit about him, huh? Interesting. So yeah, and I've seen actually cartoons now with Shazam and Superman in the same cartoon. But, yeah, like, it's a DC property, obviously, now. And there was a cartoon of that, I remember, back in the day. I'm just saying that Marvel, all their characters, they seem to have just kept internal. They don't really absorb other characters. Is that what you're saying?
I can't really think of any that they have.
Yeah. Now, when you were reading comics, when you did, what were the titles that you read, I mean, in Marvel or DC?
Well, I mean, I actually had a lot of discretionary funds to spend on comic books. So I mostly read almost all the Marvel titles back then. This is in the 70s, 60s and 70s.
What didn't you read?
I didn't read most of the DC titles. I would occasionally read Batman and Detective, which was also Batman. I would occasionally read any DC comics that were drawn by certain artists, like Gil Kane, who at the time was drawing Green Lantern and Atom. And when Kirby went over to DC and started drawing, he started doing New Gods.
The Dark Side?
Well, Dark Side is a character. I'm trying to think of the series that Dark Side is in, aside from New Gods. But that whole Dark Side apocalypse universe, and Mr. Miracle, which was also a Kirby creation, and Kirby's Resurrection of Sandman, which was, I think, very brief, and then The Demon, which was an interesting Kirby creation.
He did Spider-Man, too? He drew Spider-Man, Kirby?
Kirby, I think, drew the first version of Spider-Man, but then Ditko picked it up.
Because I guess he was one of the founders of Marvel, wasn't he?
Not exactly. Stan Lee and Jack Kirby told different stories about who did what.
Yeah, I mean, you see Stan Lee, he's still poking up in these movies. He's an old fart. But apparently he's still horny for pussy, so good for him. So when we get into this, the next few years of, like, Avengers, and they're going to do Avengers 2, and, I mean, eventually this thing is going to peter off, right? I mean, or do you think it'll just keep getting bigger?
Well, it can only get bigger up to a point.
Did you ever think, though, that they'd be able to do Iron Man the way they did? I think they did a great job.
Iron Man's, like, one of the better superhero portrayals I've seen. And they updated it really nicely, because the original Iron Man was a product of the Vietnam War. Obviously, you can't do that without making him, like, 70 years old. So they transferring the backstory to Afghanistan was very, very good.
All right, so let's talk about some recent affairs here before we go. The whole war in Iraq or Syria or wherever this thing.
Do you mean ISIS or ISIL or IS?
Or ISI, fuck. Yes. As Lindsey Graham has just recently today called it, the gates of hell spilling out.
I'm not a fan of ISIS. And I think that they do have to be dealt with, because this will snowball if it's not. But ISIS, you know, there's only like maybe 30,000 guys in ISIS right now.
Right, but is it a growing entity? Is it getting bigger?
Yeah. If they're not stopped, it's going to snowball, and it's going to be really, really nasty what happens. And they beheaded another dude yesterday.
Yeah, and I mean. what is their object? I mean, someone recently asked me that question. Like, what do they want?
They want an Islamic caliphate. That's exactly what their stated goal is.
I mean, in beheading people, though, what is their reasoning behind that? Just that they want us to stop attacking them?
No. What are their jobs? What are the jobs of the people in ISIS? What would you give as their job description?
Just fighters. I mean,
No, come on. If you were an ISIS guy and you were filling out your income tax form and they asked you what your job was, you would say terrorist, right?
So it's just like terrorists do as terrorists do, basically. Yeah. What you're saying.
Head people and show videos because they're terrorists. And I should point out that a lot of people, like forensic investigators, think that the beheading videos are fake.
What do you think?
I think that the videos are staged, but the people were actually beheaded. I think they did it for better production values.
So you're saying they're staged on the actual film, but...
The video is staged, and then they behead the guy, and then they show you a frame with the guy with his head lying on it.
Why would they do that?
It's probably less messy. I'm going to guess that whoever is producing these videos is a little more fastidious than the guys who beheaded Pearl several years ago, where they showed the whole thing.
Unbelievable. So these are fuckers. They need to be dealt with. I think they need ground troops to deal with them.
Yeah. First, I'll say this. We never should have pulled our ground troops out of Iraq. If we had left a token force there, just a token force, 1,000 guys, none of this shit would have happened.
Yep.
None of them.
I agree with that.
But
that's the American public, man. We're a bunch of assholes.
No, there's more to it than that. Both George Bush and Barack Obama kind of had their hands tied when it came to arranging the pullouts, because al-Maliki was under the gun from Iran, who were basically saying,
"Get them out."
Part of the deal that you make with the Americans has to be they pull out. You got to be hard line on that. So he was, and neither Bush nor Obama really pressed the issue too much. So although Bush says, or not says, but said prior to this all happening, a year prior to it happening, he said, if we pull out, this is going to happen, and it's basically what's happening now. So, yeah, and it didn't take a genius to see that, but I'm not really sure why the U.S. caved at that point and said, yeah, sure, we'll pull out all ground troops. I think that was you can pretty much discount all the other blunders in Iraq, which were considerable, the most considerable of which was installing a democracy, scare quotes, but the worst blunder of all was then just pulling out.
It was ridiculous, because the idea that it would just somehow work out is really...
That's stupid. The one correct thing that senile old idiot John McCain has said in recent years was, we need to have a presence there for at least the next 10 or 20 years.
And maybe 100.
Well, probably not 100. Probably 25, 30 years. Look how long we've had a presence in Western Europe.
That's the thing. Like, when you do a ground war, you must occupy the area well after you conquer it, because it's just that every single conflict we've ever been in, we're actually still there. So
we're still there. We still have troops in Japan and Navy in Japan. And although at this point it's not an occupation force, it's an allied force, because we help them protect their interests. It's no longer like we're making sure that, like, you don't have another Hirohito or Tojo. It's now we're allies. We have all this military might. We'll help you, and we know that China's over there and North Korea's over there. Same in Germany and other parts of Europe. Even though we've reduced our presence considerably, we still have well over 100,000 troops there. I mean, we had many, many, many more. Like, when I lived there, there were probably the school that I went to, which was a Eusebius school, I think there were like 100 of those schools, maybe more. There's like 3 now or 4.
But whatever. I mean, the point being that you don't just leave. You know, the same thing happened in Vietnam, kind of.
We pulled out of Vietnam and just left it to shit. But the point is you have to maintain stability in the region. And it goes beyond occupation. Like when we first had Germany, well, not just, you know, Europe in general, that part of Europe, under the Marshall Plan, it was largely occupation in Germany and occupation and then helping the new West German government protect themselves against the East German government and their Soviet puppet masters. And to a degree, part of our presence in Europe still revolves around protecting Europe from Russia, which is why I'm a big fan of moving a little further into Eastern Europe and helping the Poles and the Ukrainians set up their defense system a little better, which was, I think, the original plan under the Bush administration, and then it never really happened. It was supposed to happen under the Obama administration, and I think he was like a little scared of offending Putin. I'm not really sure what the deal is with that. Obama's foreign policy has just like really fallen to shit in just the last year and a half.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Supported his foreign policy, like not all of it, but like at least 50-60% of it.
Okay, well, you can give him at least that he's going to, I think he's realized, I think.
He's not a complete idiot. He knows that like the pooch has been screwed, but his options in terms of like unscrewing the pooch are very limited. It's not like he can do anything concrete now. Anything he does is going to basically earn him severe criticism at the very best, no matter what he does. Like, if he says, well, we shouldn't intervene, then you're going to get howls from not just from Republicans either, from most of the Democrats in the Senate. And if he says, we're going to have to put boots on the ground, then he's going to get libertarians and far-right Republicans saying, no, we shouldn't do that. So he's kind of in a bind, you know.
He is, but the fact is that he's going to get. They have to put boots on the ground if they want to defeat this.
Not a whole lot of boots, but you need ground troops,
just to come in,
yeah. Take over the area that's been kind of wiped clean of ISIS. Do the final cleanup and then establish a stronghold there, train the new guys, the locals who are going to take it over. And this is shit that should have – we should have had a trained Iraqi military 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. And I don't
They shouldn't have de-bathified it, though, probably.
No, they had to. I don't think the Bush administration realized just how difficult it would be. I think that the Bush administration thought, oh, well, you know, these guys are competent. We should be able to train them easily. It's like, no, they're fucking idiots. It'll take a generation to train them properly.
You have to let all the people that remember the last regime die off before you leave there. I mean, that's the problem, because these guys have been beaten down their whole existence, and now you're going to train them to be the police of their...
It doesn't work. And that was kind of a major fuck-up, expecting that to really, you know, oh, we're going to train the Iraqi military and their police forces to kind of take over our role. Yeah, that's wonderful, but let's stay there for a while they're being trained, because it's not going to happen in 2 years or 5 or 10.
Well, the problem is that Barack Obama comes into the office saying that he's going to do this, and this is basically, a popular idea in the country, unfortunately, at the time, and so he followed it. But
he was one of the people who pushed that idea.
He what?
He was one of the people who pushed that idea.
He was. He campaigned on it.
But then there came the briefing. Like, my understanding, because, you know, every incoming president gets the briefing, right, with the old president and all the heads of security, and my understanding was that Obama was so shocked after the briefing that his hair like turned white, not literally, but like he was just in a state of shock because he was like, oh my God, everything I've always believed in is completely wrong. That's not like what the way I thought reality worked is like counter to the way reality works. Holy fuck, what do I do?
Yeah, he was stunned by it all. But his
been elected. Oh shit, I can't quit. You know.
I mean, it's funny because a lot of people thought that he probably wanted to lose the election to Romney, you know, but like he's sick of this shit.
I think he might have wanted to lose the election to Romney, but Romney was just like such a horribly pushed candidate, and I think Romney actually could have been a legitimate candidate, but he never was a legitimate candidate because I don't think the Republican Party ever was really behind him.
Yeah, it's going to be tough though for Rand Paul, but to get the party behind him.
I don't think Rand Paul will have any problems.
Well, there you go, Rand Paul versus Hillary Clinton. That's the matchup.
It's not going to be Hillary Clinton. It's going to be Elizabeth Warren. Hillary Clinton might give Rand Paul problems, although she would be beaten basically by the tagline, "This will be Barack Obama's third term."
Well, she'll be campaigning on, "I'll be Bill Clinton's third term."
Yes, that'll be her campaign. But the Republican counter campaign is, it's Barack Obama's third term.
But don't you think the sole strength of the Hillary Clinton candidacy is the fact that Bill Clinton will be back in the White House?
Yes.
I mean, there's nothing else appealing about her.
If you actually analyze her, she's a terrible candidate. Why Democrats would be behind this woman, I have no fucking clue. She's right-wing as all fuck.
And she's a bitch. I mean, she really is.
She's an absolute cunt. And she never accomplished anything in her years as Secretary of State. Like, she accomplished nothing good anyway. She got an ambassador raped to death by Arabs. But, you know, other than that, she didn't really do anything. So what possibly can you, if you're a Democrat, what can you possibly say about her that's good?
And if Bill Clinton died tomorrow, her candidacy would be over.
Also, my understanding is she's having health issues. So, you know, I don't know how viable a candidate she would be on that basis. Although Dick Cheney managed to make it through two terms as vice president with like a half a heart. But I still foresee Elizabeth Warren as being the ultimate Democratic Party candidate, and I think that Warren gets steamrollered by Rand Paul. Like, she'll maybe win three or four states.
It'll be McGovern versus Reagan, right, or whatever. Or what was it, McGovern versus Nixon. Nixon? Yeah.
It'll be about on that magnitude. The biggest rout ever was Reagan's second term, in which he ran against Mondale. Mondale carried one state. I forget which one it was, but let's not forget how significant this is. Reagan took all the blue states except for one.
Yeah, well, he's
people
in one of
New York voted for Ronald Reagan. Like, everyone forgets this shit now. They're like, oh, everyone was against Reagan. There was a mandate against Reagan. No, there was a mandate to reelect the guy. Everybody loved Reagan.
They did.
Everyone, except for a few fucking loudmouth malcontents, loved Reagan. Because Reagan, despite his flaws, made things work.
But he wasn't a hardcore right-winger.
No, no.
I think that gets repainted as such.
This is
the
guy who used to be a Democrat. He became a Republican based on mostly fiscal policy, not like foreign policy issues or anything like that.
But his I remember he was kind of considered to be not too bright.
No, that's absolutely untrue. Reagan was a very intelligent guy.
Oh, I know he wasn't, but do you know that they did try to make him out to be stupid, didn't they?
Yeah, but, it turned out to be kind of like the Saturday Night Live Phil Hartman parody of Reagan, where Hartman, like, pretends to be a doddering old fool in public, and then, when he's with his staff, he's like, all right, you do this, you do that, you do that. Let's synchronize our watches. And you know, everything is right on the money. And I think that what Reagan was very, very good at was he was good at picking people as his delegates who could get the job done. He had a great cabinet.
Yeah, I mean, that's what a good leader does. I mean,
you can't expect your president to be your Secretary of State and your Secretary of Defense. They have to pick good people. And I think George Bush was successful in this, too. I mean, a lot of people hated Donald Rumsfeld, but I think he was very good at his job. I mean, you might disagree with what he did, but he did it pretty well.
Well, you know, when you saw what happened after he left, it got worse. So
exactly. Look at what happened after he was no longer Secretary of Defense.
Yeah, and he was a hard ass about it, but he kind of had to be.
You can disagree with the entire thing, and reasonable people can debate over that. But as far as his effectiveness, he was definitely not a bumbling incompetent.
Well, yeah, and I found his replacement to be a kind of, like a Bush senior era guy, a little bit, a little too soft-spoken for that kind of position.
Yeah,
but
also Bush's choices for Secretary of State were stellar.
Who were they now? Ray Rice?
It was Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. Compare those to Hillary Clinton and John Kerry. Come on.
Okay, all right. But when you have, you look back on it, it was kind of a chaotic presidency, a lot of stuff happening. I mean, it was right after 9/11, so there was a lot of craziness.
It got held together pretty well, considering, like George Bush got through two recessions and did pretty well in getting through them. I mean, financially, things fell apart at the very tail end of his last term. People forget this. It wasn't until September of 2008.
Well, it was that damn housing bubble that killed us here. But
it was the lending crisis and the housing bubble, which kind of went hand in hand. But these things happened in September of 2008. This was at the very tail end of Bush's presidency.
Well, that's the whole trick, man. You gotta get, like, Bill Clinton. The reason he gets all his credit is because the crash didn't come until after he left.
That's not exactly true. We were already technically in a recession when Clinton was president.
But it wasn't perceived yet.
It wasn't perceived, but because you don't tally the growth figures until two quarters later. But we did have two consecutive quarters of negative growth, the last two under Clinton. That's a recession.
Well, the whole idea, though, is, I mean, regardless, it's kind of the luck of the draw when you get down to it, whether or not these things are perceived to be on your watch or not. Because
a lot of what happens is based upon things that happened 30 years ago. It's not necessarily a result of, let's say,
your policy.
Bush or Barack Obama. Well, actually, Barack Obama has been a little more hands-on with the economy. I don't know if his people realized to what degree Obamacare would disrupt the economy, but it has.
Oh yeah. Well, it's completely reconfigured it. But I mean, I think there's a way to make it work. It just has to be dramatically changed in many ways.
I think it needs to be repealed and rewritten. I think
isn't that the same thing? I mean, ultimately, they'll do something like that. They'll like repeal a bunch of parts of it and then put in other parts.
You can repeal parts of it because it was passed that way. It was passed in what's the term that's used when the Senate does that? Like it's a bad thing when Republicans do it, but it's a really good thing when Democrats do it. There's a term for it, and you're basically passing portions of the bill as a whole as individual acts, and then
as a budget item.
Budget item. It's like that, but that's not exactly the way they do it. Now, I forget the term for it.
It only takes a 50. It only takes a 51 threshold,
right.
and there can be no filibusters for it. You know.
Right, that's the whole thing. You don't need a vote of 60. It's considered, if it's not your party doing it, it's considered sneaky. If it's your party doing it, it's considered a great move.
It's called reconciliation.
Reconciliation vote. Right. It's a reconciliation vote.
And the idea is that it's reconciling budget numbers, and so therefore it can't be subjected to a filibuster because that would just be too much. So they sneak a lot of stuff in that way, and but my feeling is it's like I guess they'll just do they just do the next budget reconciliation on a 51 vote, and they get it through that way, and they have to do it each year.
Or I think so. Yeah,
that's so they've been re-upping the, I mean, re-establishing the budget for Obamacare every year since they passed it.
I think that's how it works, which can lead to some interesting things when the Republicans take the Senate.
Yeah, see, they can actually defund it by blocking their reconciliation, which they would be able to do if they had the numbers. So,
yeah, the problem with just outright defunding it is then what do you do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the. I mean, if they see that as the root way to get rid of it, you know, I think you would just go back to the private industry. But
well, no, I mean, you can't just go back the way it was. No one's going to stand for that. Not even hardline Republicans are going to stand for that.
I think the liberals, they like the fact that Obamacare is failing because they want it to be as an excuse to basically extend Medicare to everyone.
Yeah, yeah. That's not everyone in that part of the Democratic Party, but certainly like everyone like from Warren out to the left is probably thinking that.
And you could argue too that Obamacare was a secret plan to get single payer.
Some people think so. I think that's a wild conspiracy theory.
Yeah. It's a plan that you know, if it had a public option in it, it would probably be better. It would solve a lot of the problems that we're seeing. To me, it's like the public option could include all the exemptions for abortion and all the things that people object to. That couldn't be in the government plan, obviously, but the private plans could do whatever the hell they wanted. Which I mean, I guess they can now.
So long as they're not funded by taxpayer dollars or subsidized, you can't have taxpayer-funded abortions.
Right. So, I mean, if it were a public option, obviously that wouldn't include abortions.
You know what? The thing about abortion and public funding is Planned Parenthood does get a certain amount of public funding. This isn't, like, popularly known, but they do. And you can't tell me that they keep their books so separate that none of that goes to paying for abortions or for subsidizing the cost.
Not one penny, Zork. Penny? No, I'm just kidding. I have no idea. But
no, I'm pretty sure that some of it's got to go to that. And I'm not saying, well, we have to maintain strict separation when it comes to Planned Parenthood, although I think Planned Parenthood is kind of a sleazy organization with a bizarre racist and eugenics-driven background.
I've heard that. Now, the idea is that they set up in very minority-type neighborhoods just trying to reduce the output of brown babies.
that was actually Margaret Sanger's stated intention, and I take this from her own writings, not from, like, some weird right-wing interpretation of her.
I mean, if you just take it as sort of a an anti-poverty initiative as well to keep the numbers of the poor from swelling.
She believed that blacks were poor because they were black.
Whatever the original motivation, I mean, isn't it a good idea to control the birth rate in these poor areas? I mean,
then you actually are entering into eugenics when you start justifying that. Going over an ethical line when you say,
is eugenics all bad? I mean, isn't eugenics
I don't think eugenics is necessarily bad. I'm talking about what the popular perception of eugenics might be. I don't necessarily disagree with the concept of maybe reducing poverty through reducing births. I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing, but it's a very touchy subject when you're, like, preferentially reducing births in black and Latino communities. Not that I think that we need more poor minorities in the world. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying the public perception of that is like, whoa, what the fuck? you know?
Yeah, well, this whole Christian idea, though, of like, you know, no birth control, no abortion, you know, I mean, it's just...
That's not a Christian thing. No birth control is not a Christian thing. That's a Catholic thing.
Yeah, a Catholic thing, right, you're right.
Those of us who are Christians who do not believe that Roman Catholics are Christian. As far as abortion goes, I can't think of a single Christian denomination that approves of abortion. I can't think of more than one religious organization that to whom abortion is okay, and that's Reformed Judaism. Actually, Orthodox Judaism is kind of open about abortion because they have a flexible viewpoint as to when a fetus is viable. But it's only Judaism, and Judaism that's based on Talmudic teachings.
Which are evolving,
right. Because Talmud can be interpreted. It's not like, let's say, the Constitution or something like that, which, you know, you've got a limited means of interpretation. You can't be like, well, the Second Amendment means muskets. It's like, no, it's pretty clear. It's two firearms what pen and ink is to freedom of speech, and we're discussing this via cell phones.
The Talmud, in truth, is a living document. As the Constitution is not.
Well, Talmudic commentary is. The Talmud itself is the Pentateuch.
Well, yeah, I mean, but the interpretations that are given, it's constantly being added to, is the idea, or the comment section or whatever.
There's the classical rabbinic commentary on it, but there's also modern rabbinical commentary on it. So, yeah, but my point is, abortion's never been a religious no-no in Judaism.
Well, we can leave that aside, but I mean, the birth control, like condoms and things like that, I mean, don't they keep abortions from being needed?
I'm going to say that first, I oppose abortion as a means of birth control. Abortion should not be casually used as a means of birth control. And the instant someone steps up and says, nobody uses it for that, my response is, my own grandmother used it for that many, many times. It was a major cause of the health problems that plagued her later in life. So,
yeah,
no one can tell me that nobody uses abortion as birth control.
No, a lot of people do.
It totally happens.
It's unfortunate, but it's true. And in fact,
I don't think that most people who use it as birth control plan to get pregnant and then have an abortion. That's a different thing.
Well, yeah. Well, then I think that's what people kind of conjure in their mind, that you're like, if you don't use a condom because you figure, oh, I'll just get an abortion.
I'll just get a free Obama abortion.
So you're perfectly accepting of the birth control up to the point of the ones that induce abortion.
No, I'm not.
Oh, you're not?
No.
You're against birth control.
No, I'm not against birth control. I'm against things like Ella and RU486, and it's not for any real ethical reason. It's because they pose very real health risks, and they're not really effective. If people knew how abortion pills worked, and I'm talking again specifically Ella and RU486, if people understood the mechanisms through which they worked, they wouldn't be allowed. Trust me.
Well, those are the controversial ones, and of course, you know, below that, you're fine with birth control.
Yeah, birth control is fine. I mean, I think it's weird. I think I don't object to it on any kind of ethical level or anything like that, or religious level. And I don't think that most non-Roman Catholic Christians do, but on a physiological level, I think it has some problems. You're changing people's, to a degree, their psychological makeup by giving them an artificial influx of hormones.
Yeah, that's for sure.
There have been a few studies on this, and some of them are very interesting, like women on birth control tend to choose guys to marry who are completely wrong for them.
Wow. So that's because their estrogen level's so high.
Your hormonal levels get so fucked up that your perceptions, or what you think are your perceptions, get
changed.
The way that we pick mates on a chemical level is based on immune systems. We emit a series of complex signals, mostly based on smell and taste, that tell other people what our immune systems are like in relation to theirs. And most of us with healthy bodies will pick, and this isn't a conscious pick, but it is the way we pick things chemically, we'll pick someone who has an immune system that's close to the opposite of ours. And that makes for more hardy offspring. But women who are on birth control pills tend to pick men who have immune systems very similar to them.
Interesting. Well, that's a fascinating little fact there. Those probably aren't good to take, although they give you bigger tits if you're a girl.
Cause breasts to grow. I can't not be in favor of them. It's just that, like, on a health level, they're really less than optimal.
Yeah. Well, okay, so we're about to run out of time here, but I think that we can wrap it up, and then are you good for next week?
Oh, yeah, we'll do next week.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening to Planet Zorg. Thank you, Zorg.
Okay, my pleasure.
Take care.